I dropped the unwanted toys onto my bed and then went downstairs and opened some of the holdalls. They were filled with clothes, a ridiculous amount. She couldn't possibly have worn them all if she'd changed 3 times a day for a fortnight. The next bag I opened was crammed full of small plastic toys. Dolls, animals and gifts from McDonald's. It was like a school fete tombola. I lugged the bag upstairs. "Have a look at these," I said brightly, "while I sort out the rest of your clothes. There's a toy box under the bed. You can put them in there." Her face softened and we worked side by side for a few minutes, although I sensed the peace was tenuous. I wasn't wrong. 5 minutes later, she threw a plastic crocodile into the box, then ran out of the room and into Adrian's bedroom next door. I followed. "Jodie, would you like to look around now? We can unpack later." She was pressing the buttons on Adrian's mobile, which he'd left recharging by his bed. I went over and gently took it from her. "We won't touch that. It's not ours. This is Adrian's room." She looked at me doubtfully. "He's my son. He's at school. You'll meet him later." She dropped the phone on the floor, then took a flying leap onto the bed, where she started clumsily bouncing up and down. I reached for her hand. "Come on, I'll show you the other rooms, then fix you some lunch." The mention of lunch sealed it, and with another leap she was beside me, floorboards juddering, and then she dashed out along the landing and into the next bedroom. "This is Lucy's room," I said, catching up. "She's 15. She's been with us for 2 years, and you'll meet her later too." She rushed out of Lucy's room and round to Paula's, where she spotted Paula's ragdoll pyjama case propped on the bed.
"Mine! Mine!" she cried, snatching it to her chest. "I want it!"
"It's Paula's," I said gently. "It's special. She got it for her birthday."
"Mine!" she growled. "I want it! Get me one or I'll kick you!"
I frowned and gently prized it from her arms. Was that how she'd accumulated all those toys? "Buy it or I'll kick you." I repositioned the doll on the pillow, then took her hand and led her out. I opened the door to my room just enough for her to see in. "This is where I sleep, but of course it's private. All our bedrooms are private, and we don't go into each other's unless we're asked." She grinned with a strange grimace that gave her an unpleasant, malevolent air. She stared at the double bed.
"Have you got a man?"
I shook my head. "No, I'm divorced. I have a big bed all to myself." She threw me a pitying look, and I decided she'd seen enough of my bedroom and closed the door. On the landing, I took the opportunity to reinforce our privacy rule. "Jodie, we all have our own bedrooms, and they have our special things in them. No one will come into yours, and you mustn't go into anyone else's without being asked. Do you understand?" She nodded vigorously, but I suspected her acquiescence was more to speed lunch along rather than a genuine commitment.
"I'm hungry. I want crisps and chocolate."
She lumbered down the stairs, bumping into the banister. I caught up with her in the kitchen as she flung open the drawers and cupboards.
"Okay, wait a minute, I'll find you something."
I took down a multi-pack of variety crisps and let her choose one. She wrenched open a packet of smoky bacon and started cramming fistfuls into her mouth. "What would you like in your sandwich? Ham, cheese, peanut butter or Marmite?"
"Marmite and chocolate spread."
I laughed. "Not in the same sandwich, surely." But she just stared at me uncomprehendingly.
"I want a drink."
"Can I have a drink, please?" I corrected, deciding it wouldn't do any harm to introduce some manners. I made one Marmite sandwich and one chocolate spread, then took down a glass and added some orange squash.
"Me do it,"
she said, grabbing the glass from my hand. "All right, but gently, don't grab. It's not polite." I showed her how to turn on the tap, then waited while she filled the glass. "Do you like to help, Jodie? Did you used to help at home? At your other carers?" She plonked the glass down on the work surface, then adopted the pose of an overburdened housewife, with her hands on her hips, her chin jutting out, and an expression of resolute grumpiness.
"Cooking, cleaning, and you bleeding kids at my feet all day. Don't know why I had you. You're a pain in the ass."
I could see she was role-playing, probably repeating what she'd heard her mother say, but I suspected there was also some truth behind it. As the eldest of three, she was likely to have had some part in bringing up her brother and sister while her parents were too drunk or drugged to care. It reminded me why we were going through this experience, and the flash of insight Jodie had given me into her past helped me to gather my energy and face the volatile moods and constant demands that I knew were coming. The afternoon passed, I'm not certain how. We didn't unpack, as all my time was taken up with trying to keep Jodie's attention for longer than 2 minutes. I showed her cupboards full of games, which we explored a number of times, trying to find something that would engage her. She liked jigsaws, but the only ones she had any hope of completing consisted of a handful of pieces and were designed for 2-year-olds. I had seen developmental delays before in children I'd fostered and was used to dealing with learning difficulties. Nevertheless, I was beginning to suspect that Jodie was closer to the moderate spectrum than the mild that Gary had described. We sat together on the carpet, but she hardly seemed to be aware of my presence. Instead, she muttered meaningless asides to people called Paul, Mike and Sean.
"See this bit, in there, it's a horse. I told you, I know. Where?"
They weren't the names of anyone in the immediate family that I knew of, so I assumed Jodie was playing with her imaginary friends. This kind of behaviour isn't unusual in children, even in 8-year-olds, but I'd never seen a child distracted to quite this extent.
"Who are these people?" I asked eventually.
She looked at me blankly. "Paul, Mike and Sean, are they your imaginary friends? Pretend ones that only you can see?" I was met with another uncomprehending gaze. Then she looked menacingly over my left shoulder.
"Mike, if you don't watch what you're doing, I'll kick you to death."
When Paula and Lucy arrived home at 3:30, I was trying to manoeuvre Barbie into her sports car beside Ken. I heard the door close, followed by Lucy's reaction as she saw the bags I hadn't had time to move.
"Christ! How many have we got staying?"
"Only one," I answered. To prove it, Jodie jumped up and dashed down the hall.
"Who are you?"
she demanded, hands on hips, assuming the grumpy housewife pose again. The girl said nothing, but I knew what they were thinking. With her odd features and aggressive posture, she wasn't exactly the little foster sister they'd been hoping for.
"This is Jodie," I said positively. "She arrived at lunchtime. Jodie, this is Lucy and Paula."
She stuck out her chin in a take-me-on-if-you-dare attitude.
"Hello," said Lucy, with effort.
"Hi,"
Paula added weakly. Jodie was blocking their path, so I gently placed a hand on her shoulder to ease her out of the way. She pulled against me.
"Get out!"
she suddenly exploded at the girls.
"This is my home! You go!"
I was shocked. How could she believe this when I'd told her about the girls and shown her their rooms? They laughed, which was understandable, but not advisable. Before I could stop her, Jodie rushed at Paula, kicking her hard on the shin. She jumped back and yelped.
"Jodie, whatever are you doing?"
I shouted as I turned her round to face me.
"That's naughty. You mustn't kick. This is their home as much as it is yours. We all live together. Do you understand?"
She grinned.
"Are you okay?"
I asked Paula. She'd experienced aggression from foster siblings before. We all had, but never so immediate and pronounced. She nodded, and I eased Jodie back as the girls went up the stairs. They always spent time unwinding in their rooms when they got home from school, while I prepared dinner. I took Jodie through to the kitchen and reinforced again how we all lived as one family. I asked her if she'd like to help, but she folded her arms and leant against the worktop, muttering comments, most of which were impossible to follow.
"They're not mine," she grumbled.
"The potatoes?" I responded. "No, I'm peeling them for dinner, for us all."
"Who?"
"Who are these for? For all of us."
"In the car?"
"No, you came here in the car. We're in the kitchen now."
"Where?"
she asked, lifting the lid on the pan I'd just set to boil. "Be careful, Jody," I said. "That's very hot."
"I was walking," she said.
And so it went on, with Jody mumbling disjointed phrases as though she had a basket of words and pulled them out at random. She helped lay the table, and I showed her which would be her place. We always sat in the same places as the children preferred it, and it made life easier.
"Paula, Lucy, dinner!" I called.
Adrian was playing rugby that evening, so his dinner was waiting for him in the oven. The girls came down and we all took our places. Once she was seated, Jody suddenly became angry that she couldn't sit in Lucy's place.
"Lucy always sits there, Jody," I explained. "It's her place, and that's your place."
She glared at Lucy, then viciously elbowed her in the ribs.
"Jody, no! That hurts! Don't do it!
Good girl!" I knew I should ask her to apologise, but it was our first meal together, so I let it slide. She was still staring at Lucy, who shifted uncomfortably away.
"Come on, Jody, eat your meal," I encouraged.
"You told me you like roast chicken."
The front door opened and Adrian came in, still muddy from playing rugby. He was over 6 feet tall and stooped as he entered the kitchen. I hoped Jody wouldn't find him intimidating, but reassured myself that he had a gentle manner and children usually warmed to him.
"Adrian, this is Jody," I said.
"Hi, Jody," he smiled, taking his plate from the oven and sitting opposite her. She transferred her glare from Lucy to him and then wriggled down in her chair and started kicking him under the table.
"Jody, stop that," I said firmly. "No kicking or elbowing. It's not nice."
She scowled at me, then finally picked up her knife and fork and started eating. I watched her out of the corner of my eye. She could barely grip the knife and fork, and her movements were so uncoordinated that her mouth had to be inches from the plate to have any chance of getting the food in.
"Would you like a spoon?" I asked after a while. "If I cut it up first, it might be easier."
"My gloves," she said. "It's hot!"
Then, for no apparent reason, she jumped up, ran round the table 3 times, then plonked herself down and started eating with her fingers. I motioned to the rest of the family to say nothing, and the meal passed in an unnatural, tense silence. I was relieved when dinner was over, and I suggested to Jody that she might like to help me load the dishwasher. As she came into the kitchen, she spotted Tosha sitting contentedly by the boiler.
"Why is it looking at me?"
she demanded, as though the cat had some malicious intent.
"She's not looking at you, sweet. Cats often sit and stare into space. She's found the warmest spot."
Jody lurched towards the cat with large, aggressive strides, and I sensed another kick was about to be delivered. I quickly intercepted her.
"Come on, Tosha's old. We'll leave her there to sleep."
I decided the dishwasher could wait until Jody was in bed and took her into the lounge. I tried to amuse her with more games and puzzles while Adrian, Lucy and Paula did their homework upstairs. By 7, I was exhausted. She needed one-to-one attention to keep her involved in anything, and the meaningless chatter that never stopped was starting to get on my nerves.
"Let's go up and finish your unpacking before bedtime," I suggested.
She stood up.
"I want the park."
"Not today, it's too late, but we'll go tomorrow if it's nice." She turned her back and started talking to David, another imaginary friend. I caught the odd words,
"You see, in there,"
but nothing that related to the park or the games we'd played, and I consoled myself that her imaginary world would fade in time as she started to feel safe with us. It took a mixture of coercion and repetition to persuade her upstairs, where we unpacked another bag, then changed and washed her ready for a story at 8. She found a book she'd brought with her, The Three Little Pigs. I read it to her twice, then coaxed her into bed and said good night. As I left, I went to turn off the light.
No!
She screamed in panic.
Not dark! I'm scared of the dark! You stop it!
All right, sweet. Don't worry. I turned it on again, then dimmed it to low, but she still wasn't happy. She would only stay in bed if it was left on full. Would you like your door open or closed? I asked, as I ask all the children on their first night. How they sleep is very important in helping them to feel secure and settled.
Closed, she said. Shut tight!
I said good night again, blew her a kiss, then closed the door and came out. I paused on the landing and listened. The floorboards creaked as she got out of bed and checked the door was firmly secured before returning to bed. At 9, Adrian, Paula and Lucy came down to make a snack and we sat together in the lounge. I had the television on, but I wasn't watching it. I was mulling over the day's events. Well, what do you think? I asked, smiling at Lucy as she handed me a cup of tea.
She's weird, said Lucy, sitting down next to me.
I don't like her, said Paula,
then looked at me sheepishly, expecting to be told off. And what about you, Adrian? What's your first impression?
She reminds me of that doll Chucky in the horror film. You know, the one that's possessed by the devil.
Adrian, I admonished, but I felt a cold shudder of recognition. With her broad forehead, staring blue-grey eyes, lack of empathy and her detachment from the real world, she could easily have been possessed. I caught myself. Whatever was I thinking? She was just a child who had been through some miserable times and needed our help. There was nothing more sinister to it than that. I had taken this challenge on, and now I owed it to Jodie to see it through for as long as she needed me. Part of her problems, no doubt, stemmed from people falling at the first hurdle when it came to dealing with her and passing her on for someone else to deal with. I couldn't do that to her again. I tried to look relaxed. I'm sure she'll improve with time.
Chapter 5. Self-Harm. Perhaps I was haunted by the lingering image of the possessed doll, for suddenly I was awake, with my eyes open and my senses alert. I turned and looked at the alarm clock. It was nearly 2:15 a.m. I listened. The house was silent, yet something told me all was not well. A sixth sense from years of looking after children. I eased my feet from the duvet and felt for my slippers. The house was cold, as the central heating had switched off for the night. I fumbled to get my arms into my dressing gown, tied it loosely, and opened the bedroom door. Suddenly, I gasped in shock. Jodie was standing outside the door, her face covered in blood.
What is it? What have you done? I frantically searched her face and neck for the source of the blood. Where are you hurt? Tell me, come on, quickly! I couldn't find anything, but the blood was fresh. In a trance-like state, she slowly raised her hands and showed me her palms. They were smeared with blood, but I still couldn't find any sign of a cut. I pulled up her pajama sleeves, and then I saw it. She had a cut on her left forearm, about an inch long, which was lightly seeping blood. I steered her into the bathroom and took her to the sink. I turned on the tap and ran the cut under cold water. She didn't even flinch, and I wondered if she might be sleepwalking. Jodie, I said loudly. Jodie, can you hear me? She grinned at her reflection in the mirror, and I knew that she was awake. What happened? How did you do this? She met my gaze in the mirror, but said nothing. I washed the wound thoroughly and examined it. It wasn't deep and wouldn't need stitches, so there shouldn't have been nearly this much blood. It seemed that she had smeared the blood deliberately for maximum effect. But how? And why? No one had mentioned anything about Jodie self-harming, but I doubted this was the first time she'd done it. I looked closer, and saw there were other fine pink scar lines running up both arms. How recent they were was difficult to tell. "Stay here, Jodie," I said. "I'm going downstairs to fetch a bandage." She grinned again. That strange, mirthless smile seemed to hold meanings I couldn't fathom, and it gave me the shivers. I covered her arm with a clean towel, then went down into the kitchen, where I opened the first aid box and took out a large plaster. My mind was reeling. She wasn't even distressed, which made it all the more worrying. Just as before with her soiling herself, there was that cool calmness and detachment that was so strange in such a young child. It was as though she didn't feel the pain, or perhaps wasn't even aware of what she'd done. She couldn't have cried out when she'd cut herself, as I would have heard her. Years of fostering had made me a light sleeper. I suddenly had an awful image of Jodie sitting silently in her room, squeezing the cut, then wiping the blood on her face. Upstairs again, I found her looking in the mirror, grimacing, but not from pain. She appeared to be trying to make herself as ugly as possible, screwing up her face and baring her teeth in a lopsided grin. I peeled the backing from the plaster, sealed the cut, then wet the flannel and wiped her face and neck clean. I washed my hands in hot, soapy water, remembering too late that I was supposed to wear gloves when dealing with wounds to prevent cross-infection. In the panic of the emergency, I'd forgotten. When she was clean and dry again, I felt a sense of normality returning. "All right, Jodie," I said encouragingly. "Let's get you back into bed." She still didn't speak. I led her round the landing as Lucy appeared at her door. "You okay, Kathy?" she asked, her eyes only half open. "Yes, don't worry. I'll explain tomorrow." She nodded and shuffled back to bed. In Jodie's room, I found her duvet in a heap on the floor. There was no blood on it, but on top was a small fruit knife I'd never seen before. I picked it up. "Where did you get this?" I tried to keep the accusation out of my voice. She finally spoke.
"Hilary and Dave's."
Her previous carers. "Do they know you've taken it?" She shook her head mischievously, as though being caught out in a game. I could hardly tell her off. I was more annoyed with the carers for giving her access to it, but I did understand. I had learned only from experience that leaving a child for 15 seconds in the vicinity of the kitchen could produce untold dangers. I'd once fostered a teenager who had self-harmed, but I'd never known a child of Jodie's age doing it. If a child has been physically abused at home, they can have very little respect for their bodies and are often careless about hurting themselves. Deliberate self-harm is relatively rare and is usually the preserve of teenagers. I'd never heard of an 8-year-old purposefully slashing herself with a knife. It was very worrying.
"Have you taken anything else?" I asked gently.
She shook her head, but I checked the room anyway, then remade the bed. "Come on, in you get. We'll talk about this in the morning." She shook her head angrily.
"Park!"
she demanded.
"I want to go to the park, you said."
"It's the middle of the night, Jodie. We'll go tomorrow. No one goes to the park when it's dark. All the gates are locked."
"Open them!"
"I can't. I haven't got the keys." I realised the absurdity of this conversation. "Jodie, get into bed and go to sleep before you wake the whole house."
"No, don't want to."
She made towards the door. I caught her lightly round the waist and gently drew her to me. "Come on, good girl. Into bed and I'll tell you a story. We'll go to the park in the morning when it's light." She struggled for a moment, then flopped against me. I eased her into bed and drew the duvet up to her chin. I looked at her little head on the pillow, blonde hair falling over her face. I perched on the bed and stroked her forehead until her features relaxed. "Jodie, you must be hurting very badly inside to cut yourself. Is there anything you want to tell me?" But her eyes were already heavy with sleep.
"Story," she mumbled. "Freeuckle pigs."
"All right," I continued to stroke her forehead. and began the story which I knew by heart. Her eyes closed, and her breathing deepened. I kissed her cheek, then quietly came out and closed the door. At 5 o'clock, I was woken by a loud crash. I threw on my slippers and dressing gown and staggered to her door, disoriented from lack of sleep. I gave a quick knock and entered. "Jody, whatever are you doing?" She was up and dressed with a football in her hand and the contents of the shelves strewn across the floor. "Put that away," I said crossly. "You don't play ball in here."
"I do."
She clutched it protectively to her chest. I went to take the ball from her, but she gripped it tighter. I was annoyed with myself, as I should have known it would only make her more defensive. I changed tack. "Okay, Jody, you put it down and get back into bed. If you can't go to sleep, sit quietly and look at a book. I'll tell you when it's time to get up." I didn't wait for a reply, but came out and closed the door. Without a full-scale confrontation, I hoped she might do as I'd asked. I waited and listened. The room fell silent, so I returned to bed and propped myself on the pillows. 5 minutes passed, then I heard her door open, and then another. I ran along the landing in my nightdress and saw Adrian's door open. I rushed in and found her trying to climb into bed with him. "Jody, come away," I cried. "Not in there." I eased her off. She was a big girl and a dead weight without cooperation. Adrian groaned and turned over. I put my hands under her arms and manhandled her out onto the landing. She plonked herself down on the floor, folded her arms, and set her face into a scowl. I took a deep breath and knelt down beside her. "Jody, you can't stay here, pet. Come into your bedroom and we'll put the television on. Everyone else is asleep." She thought about this for a moment, then threw herself onto all fours and started crawling towards her room, her hands and feet thumping on the floorboards. I followed her in, relieved that I'd had even this much cooperation. She sat on her bedroom floor, cross-legged, staring expectantly at the blank screen. I switched the TV on and flicked through the channels. It was too early even for children's programs, but the football seemed to capture her interest.
"Keep the volume down," I whispered. "Then you won't wake the others."
I wrapped the duvet around her shoulders, then returned to my room for my dressing gown and slippers. I went downstairs and turned the central heating on. It wasn't worth going back to bed. I wouldn't be able to sleep now. My thoughts were going 19 to the dozen and my head was buzzing with everything that had happened. I made a cup of coffee and took it into the lounge. Jody's room was directly above and all was quiet. I sat on the sofa, resting my head back, and took a sip. Suddenly, the calm was shattered by a man's voice, booming loud with distortion. I gasped. The racket was bound to wake the whole house. I rushed upstairs to her room and instinctively turned off the TV.
"It's mine!"
she shrieked and lunged at me with her hands raised into claws.
"I want it! Get out! Get out of my fucking bedroom!"
I took her by the shoulders and held her at arm's length. "Jody, calm down and listen to me. I told you to keep the volume low. Everyone is asleep and you'll wake them up with this noise. When you're calmer, we'll put it on again. Do you understand?" She made eye contact.
"I want the TV."
"I know, but shouting and swearing won't get it." I was too tired to give her a lengthy lecture. "Now sit down and I'll switch it on, but keep the volume low." She resumed her cross-legged position on the floor, and I turned the TV on. I tucked the remote into my pocket and returned to the lounge. I sat and yawned as the sun rose on a crisp spring morning. Our first night together was over. Chapter 6. A Very Troubled Child. "You mustn't thump, kick, bite, or push," I said for the third time that morning. "Not Lucy, Paula, me, or anyone. It hurts. It's bad. Do you understand?" She said nothing.
It was nearly 11:30 on Saturday, the day after Jodie had arrived, and the girls had come downstairs after their weekend lie-in. Lucy was greeted with a kick from Jodie.
"I don't want to have to tell you again, Jodie. Do I make myself clear?"
She pulled a face and stomped off down the hall.
"Sorry, Lucy," I said.
Lucy shrugged. We all knew there was not much to be done about Jodie's vicious behaviour, except to keep reinforcing that it was bad and that she mustn't do it. A moment later, Jodie reappeared, her fists clenched and flaying the air.
"It's them! I'll kick you to death! Get out! I hate you all!"
Her eyes blazed as she tried to kick Paula this time, who deftly stepped out of the way. I went towards her and avoided the kick aimed at me.
"Jodie," I said evenly, "Jodie, calm down and come here."
She screamed, then dropped to her knees and started thumping her face and head viciously. She badly wanted to hurt herself. As Jodie pounded her head with her fists, I knelt down behind her and took hold of her arms, crossing them in front of her body. She was still screaming and her legs were thrashing, but with her arms enfolded she couldn't harm herself or me. I held her close so that her back was resting against my chest. The screaming and thrashing reached a peak and then eventually subsided. I waited patiently until she was calm, then slowly relaxed my hold.
"Okay?"
I asked gently before I finally let go. She nodded, and I turned her round to face me. We were both still on the floor. Her cheeks were red and blotchy, and she looked surprised, probably because I'd managed her anger rather than fleeing for safety into another room. A moment later, I helped her up, then took her into the kitchen, where I sponged her face and gave her a drink. She was calm now, calmer than I'd seen her since she'd first arrived. I hoped she'd got something out of her system. Paula reappeared in the kitchen.
"Jodie, would you like to do a jigsaw puzzle with me?" she asked casually.
"That's a lovely idea," I said,
amazed at Paula's resilience and generosity. She understood that Jodie's violent behaviour wasn't directed at her personally. Jodie wanted to strike out at the whole world because she was hurting so much, and whoever was standing in her way would bear the brunt of her pain. Paula could sense this and was prepared to forget and offer friendship and time. I was very proud of her.
"Shall we go to the cupboard and choose one?" Paula asked.
We found a jigsaw and went through to the lounge, where Paula and Jodie settled down to assemble the puzzle. I left them to it and returned to the kitchen to prepare lunch. I could hear Paula suggesting where the pieces should go, and Jodie replying,
"That's it, my girl. You can do it."
She was like a little old woman, but at least she was relating to Paula in a positive way. With her short attention span, it didn't take long for Jodie to become bored, so Paula laid out some paper on the kitchen table and tried to help her paint while I made a cup of tea. Jodie could barely grip the paintbrush and couldn't grasp the concept of painting a picture of something.
"What's that you're painting, Jodie?"
Paula asked.
"Dark."
"Is it a sheep or a horse? It looks a bit like a big horse."
Jodie didn't respond, intent on her clumsy project.
"Maybe you could paint the sky with this nice blue."
"No, black,"
Jodie said. Despite Paula's encouragement, Jodie continued to paint nothing but large, dark splodges, with no interest in the other colours and no apparent desire for the paintings to represent anything. I'd seen this before. Children who have been abused and are hurting sometimes only use very dark colours. It's as if their senses have shut down and they don't notice anything about the world around them, so they don't see colours and shapes in the same way normal children do. We ate lunch in relative calm, although it felt more like dinner to me, having been up for so long. The piece lasted into the afternoon, and I thought now would be a good time to take the photograph of Jodie that was required for the social services records. I fetched my camera and explained to Jodie why I was taking it.
"Is it all right to take your picture, sweet?" I asked.
It was important to give Jodie as much control as possible to increase her feeling of stability and security. She shrugged, which I decided to take as consent. Paula moved to one side, so I had just Jodie in the picture. I looked through the lens and framed her head and shoulders against the wall, centering her in the viewfinder.
"You can smile, Jodie," I said.
She was looking very stern. I saw her mouth pucker to a sheepish grin, then an arm came up, and she disappeared from view.
"Very funny, Jodie. Come on, stand still."
I was still looking through the lens. Then her other arm came up, and with it her jumper. I lowered the camera.
"Jodie, what are you doing?"
"Taking off my clothes."
"Why?"
asked Paula, and quickly pulled Jodie's top back into place. She didn't answer. She was staring at me, but not scowling, so I quickly took the photograph and closed the camera.
"Jodie, we don't normally take our clothes off for a photograph," I said. "Why did you do that?"
She took a piece of the jigsaw and tried to place it.
"Want to," she said, lowering her voice. "Want to. My clothes."
"I know, sweet, but why take them off for a photograph? I didn't ask you to."
She turned to Paula.
"You helping, girl, or not?"
I smiled at Paula and nodded for her to continue. I went over to my filing cabinet under the stairs and unlocked it. I wasn't going to jump to conclusions about Jodie's behaviour, but I had to make a note of it in the log. I took out the desk diary that the fostering agency had supplied and settled down to write everything that had happened so far. The log is a daily record of a child's progress and is something that all foster carers keep. It is used to update the social workers and to monitor the child's progress, and it's sometimes used as evidence during care proceedings in court. I was assiduous about keeping it up to date, because I knew only too well how one incident could blend into another, and how disturbed nights could all seem the same after a while. Detail was important. Only with careful notes could a pattern of behaviour start to emerge. I made a note of exactly what had happened, the self-harming in the night, and the strange detachment, the lashing out at other people and violent tantrums marked by Jodie's desire to hurt herself, and this strange and unsettling response to having her photograph taken. Why had she started to take her clothes off? I was resolute that I would not rush into any hasty judgments. I needed to accept Jodie exactly as she was for the time being, and then see what came from the pattern of her behaviour. I was uneasy, though, and also found it cathartic to be able to put it down on paper. With the other two out for the day, Paula and I took it in turns to entertain Jodie throughout the afternoon, but despite this, and for no apparent reason, she threw another full-scale tantrum. I allowed her to continue for a few minutes, hoping it would run its course. When it didn't, and the high-pitched screaming became intolerable, I enfolded her in my arms as I had before, until she had calmed down. Later, I made another note of Jodie's erratic behaviour in the log. I was doing a lot of writing. Our first weekend with Jodie was an exhausting and disturbing experience. Although none of us said anything, it was obvious that we were all thinking the same thing. But it was early days, and we all knew from experience that children can settle down after an initial bout of odd behaviour. "She's a very troubled child," I said to Jill when she phoned the following Monday to see how things were going. I told her about the self-harming and the violent and aggressive tantrums.
"Yes, that is bad," Jill said. "It's very disturbed behaviour, particularly in such a young child. Do you think you can cope with her?" "I'm determined to try," I said. "She's hardly been here 5 minutes. I want to give her as much of a chance as possible. Besides, we knew she was not going to be easy from the start, so we can't be surprised if she's a handful at first. I'm keeping detailed notes of everything that happens, though."
"Good. We'll just have to monitor it and see how it goes. You're definitely the best person she could possibly be with, so as long as you're happy, I know she's in safe hands." I listened out for Jodie. She was occupied watching a Tiny Tots video, and then went through my log for Jill, trying to think of something positive to say.
"She eats well."
"Actually, she gorges. I'm having to limit her intake. She nearly made herself sick yesterday. Apart from a healthy appetite, she doesn't have much else going for her at present, I'm afraid. Do you think she can be contained within a family, Cathy? If she can't, the borough will have to start looking for a therapeutic unit, and they're few and far between. I have every faith in your judgment. I appreciated the compliment, but it was small comfort. I was already exhausted. I was worried about whether or not I'd be able to see this through, and the prospect of failing before I'd even begun did nothing for my stamina. She's got contact with her parents tomorrow, and her tutor's coming for a couple of hours next week. Perhaps a familiar face might help settle her. She's been seeing her tutor since September. Okay, Cathy, we'll see how it goes. I'll update Eileen. What are you going to do with her today? Retail therapy, courtesy of Tesco's. Jill laughed. I'll give it a wide berth. Jodie apparently loved food shopping, unlike the rest of my family who could think of nothing worse than a trip to the supermarket. She was in her element, pushing the trolley up and down, telling me what we should or shouldn't buy. In fact, she was so enthusiastic, I had to limit her exuberance and return some items to the shelves. This wasn't unusual. Children in care often seem to feel that all their problems can be solved by a bottomless purse. Children I'd looked after often had a desperate need for material goods. In the homes they had come from, money was often short, and when there was any, it was frequently spent on drink, drugs, or cigarettes. When I started buying my foster children little treats, they would often find it very exciting and pleasurable. Treats were something they had very little experience of. But I always had to be careful about managing their expectations, as they could very quickly become demanding and assume they'd be given anything they wanted. Jodie was a different case, though. From the looks of her luggage and her weight, treats had never been in short supply, which meant that she was used to getting anything she fancied. I hope it wasn't going to be too much of a struggle restricting her to a sensible limit, but experience was already teaching me to expect a battle. 3 packets of cereal is plenty, I said. Choose one you'd like, and we'll put the others back. She wanted them all, of course, and every packet of biscuits and every dessert in the freezer cabinet, so I was spending as much time taking things out of the trolley as I was putting them in, but at least she was occupied and content. It took nearly 2 hours to complete the weekly shop, and as we finally reached the checkout, Jodie spotted the display of sweets, tantalizingly placed at the side of the aisle. I started unloading the trolley onto the belt and told her to choose a bar of chocolate as a treat because she'd been such a good girl and helped. One, I repeated, as the bags of sweets started raining into the trolley, but I could see her previous cooperation was waning fast. Take the chocolate bonbons, you like those?
Want them all!
She shouted, and then sat on the floor defiantly. The woman queuing behind us was clearly unimpressed by my parenting skills and shot me one of those looks. I unloaded the last of the shopping, including the bonbons, onto the conveyor and put the other sweets back on the rack. I watched Jodie out of the corner of my eye. Her anger was mounting as she crossed her legs, folded her arms and set her face in a sneer. She kicked the trolley so that it jarred against my side. I clenched my teeth, pretending that it hadn't hurt. I pulled the trolley through the aisle and positioned it at the end, ready to receive the bags of shopping. "Are you going to help me pack?" I said, trying to distract her. "You were a big help earlier, and I could do with your help now." She refused to make eye contact, and I began to wonder how I was going to remove her from the aisle, but I was determined that she wouldn't get what she wanted by making a scene in public.
"Don't want those sweets!"
she suddenly yelled.
"Don't like them!"
I looked at her. "Don't shout, please. I've said you can choose one, but hurry up. We've nearly finished." People were now openly staring. Petulantly, Jodie hauled herself to her feet, picked up a family-sized bag of boiled sweets and threw them at the cashier.
"Jodie!"
I turned to the cashier, who was busy exchanging meaningful glances with the woman behind us. "I'm so sorry." I paid, apologised again, and we left. Outside, I ignored Jodie's screams for the sweets and pushed the trolley fast towards the car. I unlocked the doors and strapped her under her belt. Stay there while I load the bags into the boot. I'm cross, Jodie. That was very naughty. I watched her through the rear window. Her jaw was clenched as she muttered to herself and thumped the seat beside her. I knew how she felt. I was in the mood for thumping the seat myself. It had been a draining experience already, and all I could do was prepare myself for more hurricanes and hysteria. Giving in to tantrums wouldn't help her or me in the long term. I took the trolley back and then got into the front seat.
Give me the sweets, she growled. Want them now.
When you've calmed down and apologised, Jodie. I'm not having that behaviour in public.
Give me them or I'll poo on your back seat, she threatened.
I beg your pardon. You most certainly will not. So, I thought, she was prepared to soil herself if I didn't give her exactly what she wanted. Is that what had happened on the first day? Was this her trying to exert her will rather than anxiety or poor bowel control? And much as I didn't want her to make a mess on the back seat, I wasn't prepared to give in to this kind of blackmail. Jodie, if you mess on the back seat deliberately, you won't get any sweets all day. You can't just make a fuss and get everything you want. I'm sure you didn't at your previous carers.
Did? Everything. I made them.
I started the car and pulled towards the exit. I didn't doubt that what she was saying was true. Given Jodie's appalling behaviour, it was no wonder her previous carers had given in to her demands just to keep her quiet. Presumably, this was how she'd acquired the piles of clothes and toys that she'd arrived with. I glanced in the rearview mirror. She stuck out her tongue, then started kicking the back of my seat. Jodie! I know it's a hard lesson, pet, but being naughty won't get you what you want. Just the opposite, in fact.
I had everything I wanted at home,
she said, suddenly more coherent. Really? I replied, unimpressed.
I made them, or I'd tell.
I hesitated. Tell what, Jodie? There was a long silence.
Nothing. Can I have my sweets now, Kathy? I'm sorry, I won't do it again.
OK, just as soon as we get home. As we pulled into the driveway, the sour smell coming from the back seat made me realise that she had made good on her threat. It would be another unwelcome date with the shower for us as soon as we got through the front door. Chapter 7 Contact. Did the previous carers say anything about defecation as a means of control? I asked Eileen, Jodie's social worker, when she phoned the next day. It was the first time we had spoken since I'd met her at the pre-placement meeting, and I was glad to hear from her. A good social worker can make all the difference on the case, and I was hoping that Eileen and I would have a supportive working relationship. She threatens to make a mess if she doesn't get what she wants, and she's done it twice. The first time I put it down to anxiety, but the last time was in the car when I wouldn't buy her all the sweets she wanted. She threatened to soil all over the back seat, and then she did it. Eileen paused, and I was sure that the answer would be yes, although it would probably be qualified. Jodie's modus operandi was too polished to have started when she came to me. She'd clearly been using defecation as a form of blackmail for a little while. There might be something in the file. Why? Is it going to be a problem? The idea that a child threatening to poo herself when she didn't get her own way and then carrying out her threat not being a problem almost made me want to laugh. I could hear in Eileen's voice the worry that I might be about to hand Jodie back and the implication that, if so, I was overreacting a bit. Constant soiling might not seem like a big issue to her, but then she wasn't the one who had to clean it up. If I'm going to be able to meet this child's needs, I replied, it's important that I'm given all the relevant information. Could you check and get back to me, please? I'll have a look in the file, she said, but I doubted she would. If she hadn't familiarised herself with the case already, there was little compunction to do so now Jodie had been placed with me. I knew from long experience how these things worked. Eileen changed the subject. Contact has been confirmed for tomorrow, she said, using the social work term, meaning a meeting between a child and its natural parents. The escort will collect her at 6, if that's okay.
That's fine, but why is it so late?
Jodie's father can't make it from work any earlier, and he's most insistent on seeing her. He hasn't missed one yet. I heard Eileen's inference. Clearly she felt that this showed a commitment on his part, which suggested a strong attachment between father and daughter. If all went well over the next few months and Jodie's parents could get their lives in order, there was a good chance Jodie would go back to them. Generally, the social services try to rehabilitate families wherever possible. The final decision would be made by a judge at a care hearing in the family court. Was there anything else? Eileen asked, clearly hoping there wasn't.
Her behaviour is as stated.
I'd told her everything that had happened, just as I had Jill, but Eileen didn't seem to have much in the way of response to any of the reports of self-harm, violent tantrums, or anything else. I could feel my heart sinking as I realised that it was unlikely Jodie was going to get the kind of support I'd hoped for from her.
Let's hope we can make a difference, I finished.
The next morning, I was woken by Jodie stamping down the stairs at 5 a.m. I was getting used to the disturbed nights. She was calling out for me a couple of times a night and seemed to be suffering from nightmares and the invariable early starts. I'd had a feeling this would be a pattern with Jodie. In general, the more disturbed children are, the more troubled their nights are and the earlier they rise in the morning. Sometimes that can be because foster children have been used to the responsibility of looking after younger siblings and have quite often had to get their parents up in the morning and make the family breakfast. In other cases, it is because they are on constant alert and consequently unable to sleep much at a time because their survival mechanism is always switched on. So it was no surprise that Jodie was up and about at dawn. I leapt out of the bed and hurriedly followed. The last thing I wanted was Jodie left alone in the kitchen. I managed to persuade her to go back to bed, but each time I thought I'd settled her, she'd be off again minutes later. By the third time, I was fully awake, and there was no point going back to bed. I sat in the living room, trying to read, with one ear alert to what Jodie was up to. A couple of hours later, I heard Paula get up, followed shortly after by Lucy and then Adrian. I had started preparing breakfast when I suddenly heard Jodie shouting. Rushing upstairs, I found Paula standing in the bathroom doorway wearing only a towel while Jodie sat on the landing glaring at her menacingly.
"Whatever's going on?" I asked. "I'm trying to get past, but she keeps kicking me," replied Paula, obviously frustrated and vulnerable.
At this, Jodie started screaming and banging the floor with her fists and feet. I waited for her to calm down, then went over and gently lifted her to her feet and guided her towards the stairs.
"Come on, Jodie. Why don't you help me make you some breakfast? You must be hungry by now."
She resisted at first, but eventually followed me downstairs, presumably feeling that she'd won this battle, and Paula was allowed to continue getting ready in peace. Downstairs, Jodie agreed to lay the table, while I boiled the kettle and set out 4 cups. She'd already been extremely trying this morning, but as I watched her lay the table, I was reminded of how difficult her life was. Even in performing this simple task, Jodie's limitations were obvious. She couldn't grip the cutlery because her motor skills were so poor. Instead, she clamped the pile to her chest. Predictably enough, on her way to the table, she dropped one of the spoons. She grunted in frustration, then dropped the rest of the cutlery on the table, making a loud clang. She picked up the stray spoon from the floor, licked it on both sides, then wiped it on her sleeve and proceeded to set the places. It was no surprise that she was so clumsy. Poor motor skills and bad coordination are all part of developmental delay. I was no expert on the matter, but I knew that a lack of stimulation of an infant's brain could have a severe impact on its growth and development. Even being given a rattle to hold helps a baby learn about how the world works and teaches the muscles and brain to respond so that it can master its environment. Later on, reading books and playing with jigsaws and puzzles helped the brain continue to grow and learn. While I didn't want to leap to conclusions about what had happened to Jodie in the past, I couldn't help wondering if neglect and a lack of stimulation had contributed to her acute malcoordination and clumsiness. It certainly wouldn't be the first time I'd seen it, though never this pronounced.
"Well done, Jodie," I said with exaggerated enthusiasm. "You've been a big help."
She barely responded to my praise, and that too was unusual. It was odd to meet a child who didn't enjoy approval. She seemed very shut off and far away, and nothing I said seemed to reach her. I'd been expecting something of the sort, but the extent of it was beginning to puzzle and worry me. I poured Jodie some Rice Krispies and finished making the tea. Paula and Lucy came down together and sat at the table. Jodie's mood switched immediately, as it seemed to when the other children came into the room. I could see her becoming tense and her eyes narrowing with anger. She looked up at Paula with an unpleasant grimace, then started poking her in the ribs.
"Stop that, Jodie," I said,
but she persisted. Paula tried to fend her off and then lost her temper and poked her back. Jodie started screaming, making the most of the minor assault.
"Paula, you mustn't do that,"
I said, angry with her for losing control. "Now, the pair of you behave."
"Sorry, Mum," said Paula.
"And apologise to Jodie, please," I said, feeling slightly guilty. I knew Paula would feel this was unfair, with good cause, but it was in all of our interests to make it clear to Jodie that you didn't poke and you apologised after doing something wrong.
"Sorry, Jodie," Paula muttered, without looking up.
Jodie was still clutching her side melodramatically, so I decided there was little chance of coaxing an apology out of her and left it at that.
"Thank you, Paula. That was the adult thing to do."
The children left for school, and Jodie helped me to clear the table and load the dishwasher, thankfully without any mishaps. Then we sat down in the living room and I tried to interest her in some games. I decided now might be a good time to broach the subject of her contact. She would be seeing her parents twice a week for an hour at a contact centre, with a social worker present all the time. Meetings with natural parents are generally arranged some time in advance, but my policy was to remind the children only on the day, as mention of it could often unsettle them. In my experience, children tended to play up just before contact, so I made the time available for this emotional upheaval as short as possible for all our sakes.
"Jodie," I said brightly, "you'll have your bath later this afternoon because you're going to see your parents tonight."
She looked at me blankly. Had she understood? She carried on playing, mashing stickle bricks together. After a moment, she asked,
"Am I going in a van?"
"No, the escort will pick you up here in a car.